Please rise as you are able for the gospel reading. Reading from John chapter 7, verses 53 to chapter 8, verse 11. Then each of them went home while Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. Early in the morning, he came again to the temple. All the people came to him, and he sat down and began to teach them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery. And making her stand before all of them, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the very act of committing adultery. Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now what do you say?" They said this to test him, so that they might have some charge to bring against him. Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let anyone among you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." And once again he bent down and wrote on the ground. When they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with the elders. And Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Jesus straightened up and said to her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, sir." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go your way, and from now on, do not sin again." It's the word of the Lord.
Amen. And good morning. You know, I realized this morning I have nothing to say about the Super Bowl. Absolutely nothing. Yeah, hey, amen, right. I just don't have a dog in that hunt this year. But I do want to tell you about how many people here have been pulled over by the police, like been caught by the police, right? And confession's good. It's good. So, and you know, they, if it's at night, you know, they got the red and blue lights going, and then they take the spotlight and they shine it right in through your back window, and you can see it reflecting off your rearview mirror. See how much detail I'm going into here. So, and it's like you know, you're being like called out in the middle of the trap, right? You know, just in the middle of everything, and you feel awful and you feel about this big. Well, be glad that you don't live in Shenzhen, China. Because in China, in this part of China, there's a law that says you cannot use your high, if you don't turn off your high beams when another driver comes by, you can actually be fined. It's against the law. You know how you drive at night and people don't turn off their high beams or they forget or whatever, and then you're blinded by their light. Well, in Shenzhen, China, if you do this, what they do is they pull out a green chair. And they make you sit in this little green chair in front of your vehicle with the high beams on. That's how they punish you in Shenzhen, China for this. And so if you can imagine how little you feel just being pulled over, now you're sitting in a green chair next to the side of the road with high beams on you. And you have to stare into the high beams as a part of your punishment. You also have to recite the regulation and pay a fine for doing that. This is not the only thing they do. In fact, if you get caught jaywalking in this province, they catch you coming across the street jaywalking, they put a green hat on you and a green vest on you that says that you were a jaywalker. And you have to wear it for like 5 minutes and stand there on the sidewalk to watch everybody go by. And, "Oh, you got caught. Yeah, oh, you got, you know, right?" So can you imagine that? I mean, I don't know if that's working for them or not, but they certainly have gotten a lot of media attention for that. And today we're looking at somebody who got the light shined right on them, right? They got caught, right? And are in full public view. They are being exposed fully and fully shamed. So we have this woman. Now, you notice that this woman's caught in adultery, and where is she brought? She is brought to Jesus. Where is Jesus? Jesus is in the temple teaching a crowd of people. Did you got that right? So Jesus is at church, and he's talking to a bunch of people. It's like if a group of men were to walk a woman caught in adultery, right on up here and put her right up on stage with me and say, "Matt, what are you going to do about it?" That's exactly what's happening in this scenario. See, because for them, for these men, it's really not about the woman's sin. It's not about helping her at all. She's just a pawn in their game to try and trap Jesus. Now, you got to ask yourself the question, though. Where's the man? Where is the man? Because if you really read the law, and I did go back and read the law in the Torah, there are two laws that specify. Both laws say that both the man and the woman are to be brought for basically capital punishment. Where's the man? Man's not here. Only the woman is brought. Also, it took two witnesses to corroborate this sin, right? So two people had to catch her in the act. And so those two witnesses then would have had to bring her to Jesus. I think this is kind of a setup. Just my speculation. I don't know. The text doesn't say that. I think those guys were waiting. They knew about the sin in her life, and they waited. They waited for the moment. They waited for the opportunity, and they caught her in the act. They trapped her so they could bring her, but they let the guy go. The other thing we know is that this is probably a very young woman, because they say that she should be stoned, which was the form of capital punishment for a young woman who was betrothed to a man. So she was already taken a vow and a promise and betrothed, even though she had not become married. Like Mary and Joseph, Mary was betrothed to Joseph, legally betrothed, but they had not yet been married. If she had been a married woman, the capital punishment would have been different, would have been strangulation. Like, either one is a good scenario, right? But the law was trying to say that this was a capital punishment. So part of the trap was, so we know this is a young woman. She's brought to Jesus. She is being publicly humiliated. The spotlight is on her. The high beams are on her. And they're trying to really trap Jesus. This is all about Jesus. They wanted to trip Jesus up. They wanted to shame and humiliate Jesus. And they're using her as a pawn to do that. Because the law stated there were two laws at work here. The Mosaic law, which I just referred to, was the law that said, you know, purge this sin from Israel. That's the reason for the law in the Mosaic law. It says this is the punishment for adultery. But the Roman law, and the Romans were in control, said you can't do capital punishment. Roman law was against capital punishment. So you had two laws at work here, and what they were doing was saying, which one are you going to go with, Jesus? But I love Jesus because he always gets out of these things. He always finds a way to flip the script back on the people who are trying to trap him. There are a lot of traps that we go through. But they're trying to trip him up, but he flips the script. And I'll tell you how he does that in just a minute. But I want you just for a moment, what was it like to be that woman? What was it like to be in her shoes at this moment? I think she was dirt poor spiritually. She was caught in her sin, and she was guilty of this sin, no doubt. But she is now not only fully aware of her sin, but everybody else is fully aware of her sin. The crowd in the temple brought before a famous teacher named Jesus. How did she feel? I bet she felt humiliated, shame, and guilt, to name a few. Dr. Brené Brown is a psychologist who's been studying vulnerability and shame recently. She's got a TED Talk. She's got several best-selling books out about it. And in her book, Daring Greatly, she's got a whole chapter on shame. And in that chapter, she defines the difference between humiliation and guilt and shame. And she says, humiliation is what people do to us. It's what happens to us that humiliates us. So what the men are doing to her is they're humiliating her in their attempt to humiliate Jesus. So it's humiliation. Think of that as something that somebody else does to us to make us look smaller, to define us, to say you're worthless. Whereas guilt is that thing that we realize we did something wrong and we feel guilty about it, and hopefully we want to change because we feel that guilt and we want to turn things around. So she most likely felt guilt. She was guilty. But shame is a whole nother level. Here's how Dr. Brown defines shame. She says, shame is the intensely painful feeling or experience of believing that we are flawed and therefore unworthy of love and belonging. Shame is the belief that we're unworthy, that we don't belong. And I can't imagine the level of shame she felt in this moment, because she really didn't feel like she belonged, and she really felt like she wasn't loved. These men didn't care about her at all. They had no love for her. She was just being used. They had set her up and set Jesus up. But we all feel that shame. And here's some of the ways that Dr. Brown says we feel shame or experience shame in our own lives about these areas of our lives. There's a list, and it won't be on the screen, but I'll share it with you. It says appearance and body image, money and work, parenting. Any parents here felt bad about something, felt shame, right? Mental and physical health. We can feel ashamed of our mental or physical health, and we hide it, right? Addictions, sex, aging, religion. We hide our religion. We hide our faith sometimes because we're ashamed. Surviving trauma. We feel ashamed of a trauma. Or being stereotyped or labeled by other people. We feel shame. I would suggest to you that we have a culture today of shame and blame. We live in a culture today that's using shame and blame as a weapon to trap and trip people up. That's part of the culture we live in too, not just Jesus. But you know, what Jesus does with this entrapment, what Jesus does is he flips the script. And he says this to the men who've now gathered with the woman, and he says, "Let anyone among you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." In the law, it said that the two witnesses were to be the first ones that to throw the stone. But I would sense, if we went with the pull paraphrase version of this verse, if I could retranslate it based on my understanding of the Greek, I would say that Jesus said, "Let anyone among you who has never had a lustful thought cast the first stone." Because in the Sermon on the Mount, where we hear that great verse, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven," Jesus also says, "If anyone lusts after a woman in his heart, he has committed adultery." Not the act, but the lust, the desire, was the act of adultery. So if you even thought it in your heart, you are a part of that, Jesus says. And so basically that's what he's saying to them. And so notice that the old guys leave first. I don't know if you picked up on that. They get it right away, don't they? They're like, "Oh yeah, we got experience with this. We're walking away." The young guys are still there trying to, you know, prove themselves. But eventually they walk away too. And so Jesus is left there. So it's just now the crowd, the temple, Jesus and the woman. The accusers are gone. The witnesses are gone. The stones have been dropped. But there's still one more thing. And Jesus says to her, "Neither do I condemn you. Go your way, and from now on, do not sin again." So, why does Jesus do this? That's what I started to wrestle with. What's Jesus trying to do in this moment for this woman? Well, I think one thing that Jesus realizes is that condemning her will not help her see her worth. She had been used by these men, maybe used by the man that got her she was in the situation with to begin with. She's been seeing herself as unworthy. And sometimes that's why we get engaged in self-destructive behavior like this that destroys relationships, behavior that destroys ourselves, is because we're hiding something, our own shame. We're ashamed, and so we're just keep going back to these habits and these self-destructive behaviors because we don't think we're worthy of real love, God's love. So Jesus wants her to know that she is worthy of love, and the good kind of love, not the kind of love she's been engaged in or experiencing. You know, gardeners will tell you that, you know, they try and protect their gardens from infestation. You know, they put insecticides on their plants and they try and protect it from worms, you know, get little worms that come and eat the plants and bugs that come and eat the leaves and the fruit and all those things. But there's a worm called the boarworm. And what the boarworm does in a vegetable garden is that it goes in between the roots and the leaves and the branches and the fruit. There's the stalk, the main trunk of the plant. And the boarworm goes into that part of the plant, bores into it, and eats it on the inside. chews out all the inside, and then the whole plant dies because it just eats out the main source of its life. Your soul is the main source of your life. Shame and sin is the boar worm that comes into your soul and my soul and just eats it from the inside out, and then we feel empty and worthless. And then we turn to things in life that we think will fill us up. We keep chasing those self-destructive behaviors that we think will refill what the boar worm has done for to us. But it won't. It never will. It won't fill that place. We need to have that place refilled with the love and the grace of Jesus Christ that says you're worthy. God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son. Why did he do it? Not to condemn the world, but to save it. He's looking at this woman. He says, yes, you have sin in your life, young woman, but you're still worthy of God's love. You're still worthy of redemption. I think that's the other reason that he does this, is he knows that condemnation won't turn her life around. It won't help her change. It won't help her live the life that God called her to live if he doesn't give her this chance. So he gives her an opportunity at redemption. He gives her an opportunity because his greatest hope for her is that her life would change, that grace and worthiness and love would change her life and help her to become the woman of God that God has called her to be and not go back to this life of sin. So he holds that out. He holds out this opportunity because that's who Jesus is. You know, Bob Hoover was a test pilot for the Army. And he flew, in his retirement, he flew in air shows. And they would show off World War II planes in air shows. And this is a F-51, not a P-51, but they're very similar. I understand, and don't get into technical. I've already had two people call me out on a fact check me on this. But according to the story that I read, he was flying an F-51, and according to Google, this is a F-51. I'm sure somebody can correct me later. But it's really not that important, folks. You know, we can go with alternative facts all day. Whatever. It just doesn't matter. So he's flying a plane, World War II plane. Let's just call it that. How about that? And he goes up and he takes off and he's in the air show and his engine quits, just goes out on him. And so because he's a test pilot, he's got a little experience with this, so he makes an emergency landing, glides the plane in, lands it safely. They get out, check the plane over. They discover that World War II planes run on good old-fashioned gasoline, and the serviceman put in jet fuel into his plane. And this is why the engine failed. So Bob wanted to see the serviceman. I'd like to talk to this person. And who wouldn't want to talk, right? Have a little chat, right? The guy that almost killed me because of his mistake, he wanted to see him. So Bob goes over to the serviceman. He meets him, and I can't imagine how the serviceman felt at this moment to be confronted by the man you almost killed. And Bob went up, put his arm around him, and he says, I'd like you to service my plane again tomorrow for the air show. He wanted to give him a second chance. He knew, because he knew by giving him the second chance, by giving him some grace, he would get it right the next day. I think Bob maybe also thought, I don't want anybody else making the same mistake. This guy won't make the mistake, right? But that's the purpose of a second chance, isn't it? To get it right. To have redemption. To make a change. To turn your life around. That's what Jesus is offering her. He is offering her another opportunity to be the woman God already sees her to be, who already loves her no matter what. To be that person is what Jesus is holding out for her, that hope, that possibility. Last thing about this story is, you notice something about it? There's no ending. I don't know if you notice that, but there's really not an ending to the story because we don't know what she did. Did she go right back and make the same mistake again? Or did she turn her life around with this opportunity? What did she do? We don't know. But maybe John left it that way so that you and I would think about what we'd do. What will you do with the second chance that God gives you? What will you do when God says, you're worth it? Here's a second chance. What are you going to do with that grace? What are you going to do with that opportunity? Are you going to become the person that God sees you to be, or are you just going to go right back to being and doing what you've always been doing? It's your choice. I think it also has to do with what you believe. I was also this week talking with Executive Director Manna House, who happens to be an old friend of mine. We had lunch together this week, and I went down into Baltimore. Manna House is a ministry to homeless folks in Baltimore City. They've been, over the past few years, he says it's the meals that they serve, the number of people they're serving has been growing year by year. They serve anywhere from 150 to 250 meals a day to different homeless, depending on the time of the month. End of the month, they're serving over 200 people a day. And I said to him, I was asking him, talking to him and the program manager there, and we were talking about their ministry and what they're doing there in Baltimore. And I said, so the people that are coming and that you're serving, do you have any heroin addicts? Because I've just been reading about that. He says, oh yeah, there are a lot of them have a heroin addictions, mental illness, dual diagnosis, and they have all these things and they bring that with them. And I say, so where do you send, if somebody comes into you and has a heroin addiction and wants to get better, where would they go here? And he says, well, actually, we've got a recovery program right across the street. So a little time went by, and then we were having lunch, and he said, he kind of reflected back on our conversation. He said this, he said, you know, I've never seen anybody get over an addiction without the Christ. That's what he called, didn't say Jesus, called the Christ. He said, I've never seen anybody get over an heroin addiction without Christ in their life. I was like, really? Tell me more about that. He says, it's because we can do everything to treat the outside. We can feed them, we can clothe them, we can give them showers, we can give them a home, we can do all these things that will meet the outward needs that they have. But if somebody doesn't come in and change their soul, they'll just go right back. Without a change on the inside, without conversion on the inside, without Christ coming into their life, it's very hard to overcome these addictions and self-destructive behaviors without a healing of the soul. We're dirt poor, folks, in our souls. But Jesus came to redeem us, to redeem those dirt poor souls that we have. The question that we have to wrestle with is, which voice are we going to believe? The voice of shame that says you're not worthy, or the voice of grace and love from God that says you are worthy of redemption and change. Amen.